Now let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Julie.
I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. I just shocked that guy when I walked up here. I'll try not to shock you guys. If anything's scary. We're in a meeting the other night and shared some things I did besides alcohol, and somebody said they couldn't believe that I did all that stuff, and I said, yeah, I did. I used to work at a place, Paramount Citrus, out in Ivanhoe, and I kind of have a bad mouth sometimes. And this girl, I was working there, and the girl said, you know, you just look so nice on the outside, and you always dress so nice, and then you open your mouth. And I was like, golly, I was so offended. No. Okay, so we just blew right past this church. We just went right by. We're talking. Blah. I said, oh, I think we got lost. I had to turn around and come back. I tried not to kill Doug. My car's in the shop, and my husband let me drive his car tonight, which is a six shift that I haven't drove in a really long time, a six shift. So I kind of was not driving really good. So we were like Mr. Cho's wild ride on the way over here. But we made it. Had a wonderful dinner. Thank you very much again. And had a good conversation with our dinner guest. And first time I drank, I was 16 and got drunk. And last time I drank, I was 26 and got drunk. And every time in between then. And I'm from Portugal. I grew up, born and raised in Portugal. I still live in Portugal. Moved away, came back, moved away, came back, and I'm still there. And I had a very normal childhood. My dad was a farmer, and we lived out in the country, and he was a walnut farmer. Then we sold all that and just did all kinds of other farming, beans and cotton and all kinds of stuff. And so I grew up way out in the country, past Poplar, and I loved it. I had a, you know, other than it was kind of boring because you're out there in the middle of nowhere, but you know, I had a great childhood. I remember driving out there a couple years ago. I just drove around where I used to live, and I have nothing but good memories about all of that. And I went to a little Pleasant View school, you know, just a little tiny school, and everybody just, it was great. And you know, I'm 51 years old, so that was a long time ago, but I've been sober 25 years, and it's weird that I was thinking about that when I was coming up. I'm like, wow, it's like half of my life has been in AA, and I'm really grateful for that. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. Partied all through school. Never had any idea what I was going to do with my life. Everybody's asking you, what are you going to do after you graduate? Get drunk. That's about it. That's the only thing I could come up with. Get drunk. And after that, I wasn't really sure. And so I just worked jobs and went from here to there. I moved down to Santa Barbara, came back, moved to Anaheim, came back. And I'm just a small town person. I don't really like big city. And so I'm back in Porterville and got into the packing house business, started working at an orange packing house as an orange grader, and, you know, have made a career out of being in that business. And I work at a place now that I actually stole from, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they called me and asked me to come back to work there. And I had already made amends to them, so they knew all these things had happened, but they called me and wanted me to come back, and it's like, wow. And I've been there 10 years now, so you know, I just think I don't have a huge, crazy jail institution, kids, no kids, husbands, no husbands. I don't have a story like that. You know, I was 26 when I sobered up, so I think a lot of it is just because I was 26, and I hadn't really done all those things yet. But at the end of my drinking, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I would go to parties and get in my car and drive home, and I was just bawling all the way home, and at the end, it was not fun at all. I don't know what was wrong. I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't know I was an alcoholic, and I just thought, you know, everybody I went to school with got married, they got a bunch of kids, they're just got married again, had a bunch of more kids. No. But whatever, that did not look appealing to me at all. I was like, no, that would just really mess up your party. And their kids, my husband, no. I don't have time for that. So I live with my mom, you know, 26 years old. I live with my mom. And I just never thought about anything. I didn't think about, you know, what am I going to do with my life? Or I just didn't think about things like that. And so I'm 26. I don't know what's wrong with me. I start going to this group therapy, and a lot of the people in the group therapy were alcoholics and addicts, and they shared that way and introduced themselves that way, and I just thought, why the hell would you tell anybody that? And if it's true, we're going to say it in front of everybody, really? So they did, and then they suggested that I go to a meeting. Why? You know, I just didn't really understand all that. So I went to a meeting with this guy. And it was the Exeter meeting, the afternoon meeting, and everybody was smoking, and I was just like, ugh. I wasn't a smoker, and nobody gets smokers, don't get all offended, but I wasn't a smoker, and so I was just like, yeah, and then everybody's laughing, okay, then we were all laughing in here earlier, and this crowd, especially over there, and I'm telling you, for anybody that's new, and it's annoying to you, just don't worry about it, I came in here, just these people are laughing, and it just pissed me off, because I was not having any fun whatsoever anymore, and for you to be laughing, I didn't like it, and so I just was like, these people are stupid, you're all laughing, and they were laughing at some guy telling some dumb story, and I didn't like it, so I ended up drinking again, and this time, I stopped drinking for a little while, I quit all the drugs on my own, that was one thing that was kicking my rear end, and so I stopped the drugs on my own. I could not stop drinking on my own, so I drank one more time, got drunk, and then I was like, okay, I can't do this anymore. So I went to a meeting over here in Tulare. I couldn't even tell you where it was, and it was a candlelight meeting, and it was awesome. You know, all these lights was kind of intimidating, and getting up and talking was intimidating, but the candlelight meeting was wonderful, and I stepped back, and then somebody introduced themselves to me, and David L., and I just still, you know, every time I see him, I just remember that, and I thought it was wonderful, and then somebody told me there, oh, there's a meeting in Springville, you need to go to that Springville meeting. I was like, okay. So I drive up to Springville, fluorescent lights, they had a table in the front with a microphone. And they want you to get up there and talk. Oh, no way. And then some guy hugs me after the meeting, and I'm like, get away from me. And, you know, I didn't understand all that fucking crap. So, but I just kept coming back. And, you know, I was just sharing the other night, there wasn't any huge thing that happened to me, no big catastrophe, no big anything. That day that I decided to quit drinking, I was just done. I wasn't having any fun anymore. I was just done and started going to AA meetings, and I've been here ever since and was happily ever after. But happily ever after more than I would have been happily ever after. But, you know, so to talk to the newcomers, welcome to anybody that's new. If you don't know you're an alcoholic, please just keep coming back. You know, if you have a court card, come check it out. It could have been an accident. You got a little accident with that court card. You know, you just were out screwing off. It could not be an accident. Who knows? But you're here for a reason. If you're not here in a court card, you just know what the hell is going on in your life, welcome. But just the last couple minutes I want to share to people that have been here for a while. And sometimes stuff, I'm really going to try not to cuss because I don't want you guys getting all freaked out. Shocked. I don't want to shock you like I shocked that guy. So I want to talk about that because about 5-6 years ago, you know, some stuff started happening in my life that I was very uncomfortable with. And I just probably went spinning, ass crazy. I don't know what happened. I do know what happened, but I'm not going to go into it tonight. But so I'm 20 years sober, going to meetings, and I'm just like that shit crazy. So I want you to know that anyone that's been here for a while and is feeling like that, you know what? Shit happens. So you keep coming to meetings of what I did. I kept coming to meetings. I have always had a sponsor, and I switched sponsors at one time and worked with another guy, and he actually passed away a year ago, David Savovich. And you know, every single person that's been in my life, could have been there at the exact same time. You know, have spent hours and hours of time with me. And that is just wonderful. And so, and then you kind of just go to different areas, you know, and I worked with him because he had dealt with a lot of things that I was going through, and then I started talking to other people, and it's like, I don't really have a sponsor today, but I talk to a lot of people in AA all the time, and sometimes stuff just happens, and it's important for me to know I can get through it, keep coming to meetings, I don't have to go off the rail, I don't have to do anything galactically stupid that would screw up my whole life, which was what I was wanting to do, and I didn't, and it's okay to talk about it, you know, maybe not in meetings, and my sponsor would say, well, you just don't want to talk about it because you're embarrassed or whatever. I go, no, it's not that, it's like, it wasn't that I was embarrassed, I was having problems, it was just a sensitive situation that, you know, to talk about in front of everybody might not have been appropriate, so I found people to talk to and work through it, and you know, not every day is an easy day. Getting older in sobriety and things going on, it's like, wow. Sometimes it's not really easy, but as long as I stick around here, I know I'm going to be okay. And I don't go to as many meetings as I used to. I was like a 4 or 5 meeting a week person, and you know, I probably go to 2, maybe 3 meetings a week now. But it's not so much about the meeting for me. It's about continuing to work the steps and work on what's going on in here. Because if I can't keep it together in here, I can go to a meeting every night and walk out the door and just, and you know, go home and bawl every night like I did when I was drinking. I don't want to live like that. So I know that when there's bad times, there's always a good time coming up, and I'm okay with that, and it doesn't, every day doesn't have to be la 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 la, because it's not for me, you know, maybe some people's lives are like that, but it's not like that for me, and you know, I'm married today, I have a home in Porterville, and I never had any kids. We're talking about that at dinner tonight, and I have a stepson, and I can't get more grandkids. They get divorced, get married, there's a couple more, they're like 5 or 6 more. And I got 2 nephews, and you know, I my life is good, and I don't really know what else to say. He said I had to talk for 15 minutes, so he wouldn't have to talk as long. But and you know, I have to talk about Doug for a minute. Doug and I went to high school together, and we didn't know each other in high school. I mean, like, I knew who he was, but I didn't really know him. He's a little bit younger than me, and I met him at a meeting, and I said, I know you, and we started talking, and we have become very good friends, and it's amazing how he kind of came into my life when I needed somebody different in my life to talk to that I didn't really know that well, and we, you know, become very good friends, and he texted me every morning, and good morning, and I'm like, I'm on my way to work, leave me alone, and I'm always checking him back, you know, and I mean, I will just fall off my chair some days and work the stuff that he says and does. I'm just cracking up laughing. We almost didn't make it here. We're laughing so hard I couldn't see. I was crying, and we missed the road, and I turned around, and so, but it's crazy. I like to have fun like that, and all my little peeps over here, and all these girls over here from Porterville and Springville, and you know, I always wanted the party, the fun, That's what I wanted. Dog was a party girl, and I loved it. And this was like a party, just so party. And we don't have to go crazy and to be able to have fun. I can come here and be sober crazy and have fun. And it is fun. We have a New Year's dance coming up. I'm going to pitch the New Year's dance for you guys. We have a central office, you know, in Exeter, and it costs a lot of money to run that central office. And we have a couple of fundraisers every year, and so our New Year's dance is one of them, and we would love everybody to come. It's a lot of fun. It's dinner, speaker meeting. Really, for $22? Come on, like, you never spent $22 on New Year's. We know you do. So come on over, and it's a lot of fun, and we'd love to see all of you guys there. And I'm going to be quiet because I know I talked like 15, 20 minutes almost. Thank you.
Okay, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Doug. Thank you.
Good evening. My name's Doug, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, my friend Ray said that I need to start out like this, so I will. My sobriety date is August the 22nd, 2009. My home group is the acceptance group, and it's in Porterville on First and Mill. It's a great, great meeting. You know, Reyes has texted me this evening. He's been under the weather. He's a great friend of mine. He said in the text, he said, so good to have you in my life. You know, that's what this fellowship's about, because Reyes is in my life. That's an amazing thing. That man is an amazing person. Anyone of you who knows who Reyes is, he's just an amazing guy. So, anyway. Just an addendum to the little story about the ride over here. It's not just a stick shift, it's a literal black Corvette that does 200 miles an hour, and we're going like 60 down Mooney, and we're lost, you know. So anyway, but we got here, we're alive. We had a wonderful dinner, thank you very much. I just start my story out by talking about my childhood, because what I realize now, I didn't realize then. And that is that, you know, I had a mother who was a teacher. My dad was a cop. Neither one of them were drinkers. My dad, though, came from a family of alcoholics. 8 brothers and sisters, every single one of them an alcoholic. I have 32 cousins back in Wisconsin, just outside of Milwaukee, and you know what they drink. So they're drinking the beer, and 32 cousins, every one of them, every one of them is an alcoholic. So I come by it rightly. But I never saw my dad drink. My dad was, it always manifested itself in, he liked to gamble. He was a big gambler. My mother, she was a wonderful woman. She was a teacher, and she spoiled me, she took care of me. So my dad protected me, my mom spoiled me. So early on, my ego was built up real nice, you know. It was real nice, real protected, real comfortable. Did that little middle class life on Kissing Street in Porterville. And I had a half-brother. Half-brother was 16 years older than me. My mom's son by a different marriage. So by the time I was 3 or 4, in my earliest memories, my brother was off to college. So I was raised an only child. So my earliest memories of my drinking were in high school. And we had moved out to the country, first of all, back up a little bit. We moved out to the country, not very far from where Julie's place was. Didn't know that she was out there at that time. And, I went to a little school where when I graduated from 8th grade, I was 18 people in my class. So, very, like, isolated place. And my dad, by that time, had become a lawyer. He went to night school, and he became a lawyer, and so we moved out to this ranch, and I had horses, and I started to show horses. And my parents, they sent me to, during the summer, they sent me to horse trainers, like a military school for cowboys. And I showed quarter horses all over the country, and in the summertime I went out there, and I learned how to work, because my father figured, you know, this kid is, he's got to learn some kind of stability here. So I'm going to send him out there, and he's going to learn how to work. And we worked hard all day long. We were on horses from the morning until night. And then around the time the dinner came, everybody get up to this big old huge bar as long as this wall. And we'd have our cocktails before dinner, and then we'd eat dinner. And everybody else was done drinking their cocktails, and I was back by the bar ready to go again. I was like, get away from the bar. Dinner drinks are over. What's wrong with you, boy? Sit down. So as long as I had somebody like that around, I was good. So anyway, I went to high school. My earliest memories were in high school of drinking, where I really got drunk. And Julie and I were actually in the band together. She played the tenor saxophone, and I played the alto saxophone. And she was just from here to Julie over there, from me, every day, for years, never ever talked to her. You know, I guess it wasn't God's time for us to meet then. Probably a good thing, you know. so we, you know, we didn't know each other. But my first memory was that band, and we played halftime show for the Oakland Raiders, you know, and also we're in a lot of contests against, like, Soma Band Festival and stuff against Solar Union, you know, so we always beat you guys. So, you know. But it wasn't because of me, because that first night that I was drunk, a buddy of mine and I, we got one of my dad's Jim Beam bottles. He wasn't a big drinker, but he had all those decanters, like the Trains and Elvis and all that. I think I got Elvis, and I poured Elvis in a big old cup, and we were out there drinking in his truck, and then we went back out, and we're supposed to be in line and marching, and the band director's like, Doug, Doug, get in line, and I was lost in the song. And that night I went home, and I had to dry heaves all night, and my dad was standing over me the next morning going, you are going to school, and I went to school, you know. And in high school, the motivation for me to drink, and a lot of people say, well, I drank and I felt that first drink and it was so wonderful. And like, I drank because I wanted to be a part of. You know, when I came from that country school to go to that high school, I came from the country, and here I am in a high school of 2,000 people. I was a mentally gifted minor at that time. They call them gay kids now, so I had separate classes. We had the seventh period PE teacher with all the football players, and you can hear me. You can only imagine how what a nightmare that was. So I wanted to end up, you know, being a part of. And sure enough, when I started partying, I became part of it in high school, and that's what made me feel good. So, about a little after that, I can remember going to Fort Lauderdale during high school for New Year's with my mother. I bought her a beautiful dress at Neiman Marcus in San Francisco, and she was going to look good. I was all suited up. We were going to go with my brother. My brother, this time, was a successful lawyer in Fort Lauderdale, and we were going to all go to the Fort Lauderdale Yacht Club. And I'm not 21, obviously. So, but I'm drinking like crazy at the Fort Lauderdale Yacht Club New Year's. Just wonderful. Then we go to Chuck's Steakhouse, and I'm drinking. Nobody stops me. I'm just drinking some Bloody Marys. Then we go to Harvard Lawyer's neighbors of his. And they're not only drinking rum cider, but they're passing around a cigarette, which I thought looked really interesting to, you know, partake of that too. So I did all of that, and I spent the whole night out on the dock, throwing up in the water all night long. And the next morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, my mom's like, we're flying out, let's go, we're gone. You know, so that was a miserable, miserable trip. But those are the two, like, dry heaves beginning of the moment. So, it came time to go to college, and I went to Fresno State, and always assumed that I was going to be a lawyer and I was going to go to college, so that was just the next indicated step. And so off I went to college. I joined the horse show team. Back then, it was just a bunch of, you know, privileged kids. Today you go to the horse show, different schools, you use their horses or whatever. We had our big old fancy horses, and we took them other places, and we showed. And I can remember coming home from horse shows just drinking with a bottle of Bacardi between my legs, going over the grapevine with a big old beautiful horse that I love very much in the back, just drinking away. Same thing all through school, just waking up in the morning, 8 o'clock class. I'm just telling Julie on the way over here, man, you know, if I knew what I know, then, you know, these incredible classes that I was taking, that in the morning, it would take me 2 or 3 hours, and I was just done for in the morning. I was just miserable. Today, I get up, I'm like, ah, da, da. But back then, I was like, oh, God, geez, take me away, you know? But I got through college. Did a lot of heavy drinking, a lot of Bacardi and Dr. Pepper, a lot of binge drinking. I can remember going to classes and, you know, a lot of papers were due at the end of the semester, a lot of finals were due at the end of the semester, but my schedule was that when I got done with classes, I'd go to the Bucket. There was a place on, there was a bar at Fresno State called the Bucket, so I'd come out, I'd go to the library a little bit, you know, like play around at the library, pretend like I was getting a book, or get a couple of books. You know, I have a huge stack of books for my research paper, right? But it was like 3 nights before the research paper. I was like, oh my God, what's wrong? You know, so I was sharing with my friend Donna. We were talking about British history the other day, and I remember British history was after lunch, and I used to go to the Alligator Club and drink a bottle of wine at lunch, and then I'd go to British history, and I couldn't remember, and I consider myself an Anglophile, and I couldn't remember who Victoria's son was. Now, if you're an Anglophile, you need to know who Victoria's son was, but all I could remember was this bottle of wine that I drank at the Alligator Club. So I didn't shine to my best, the best of my ability. So, after I was in Fresno State for about, I'll just share with you real quick about how my mother, this is so crazy how privileged I was to have my mother. I decided that I was going to stay in Fort Lauderdale a little bit, and the first beginning of classes began at Fresno State, and I was still in Fort Lauderdale. My mother was here. My classes began. So she went to my first political science class. It was the first week of my political science class. And took notes for me. And the professor must have been like, who sends their mom to take notes, you know, for you? And he said that when I got back. He's like, who sends their mom? I was like, well, I do. So she did, and I did, and actually I ended up liking him really well. He's a really great guy, but that was the kind of person she was. You know, it's probably not the best way to raise your kids. I was sharing that with somebody the other day, because, I had this beautiful condominium. I had everything I could possibly need. It was safe. It was guarded. It was gated. I was, like, afraid of everything. I was afraid of everything, and I also missed my mommy. So I would call my mama, a 20-year-old man, beautiful place. I'm not paying for college. I'm not doing anything. All I can do is study. But I'm miserable. I'm like, I miss my mom. So I call her up. She'd drive all the way from Porterville. By the way, she was a speech therapist. She had to be at work at 8 in the morning. She'd drive to Fresno, bring my dog, stay the night, then drive back home to work the next day. Well, the reason I tell you all that stuff, other than to tell you what a psycho I was, is that in 1987, when I was 22 years old, I went with my girlfriend over to the Shore Cliff over at Pismo. And we had a bottle of wine together. My dad headed out to go to Las Vegas, as usual, with his client. And we had our first bottle of Charles Krug Cabernet Sauvignon, because I thought I was such the cavern, you know, the connoisseur. And then I had the second bottle, and we were dancing, having a nice time, and we went back to the room. And when I got back to the room, I looked at the phone. There's no blinking light. Now, that's the days before the cell phones and everything, so there's just the blinking light you're looking for. She should have been there. She should have had on the phone a message or something. Is the room all right? Do you have enough money? Is everything okay? Did you make it safe? Are you okay? No blinking light. And I was like, what's going on? So I called the lady who my dad's with. Her husband was with my dad. And I said, hey, I said, what's going on? Where's mom? She doesn't call me. She said, oh, honey. She says, you don't know. She's had a terrible accident. And I said, she's had an accident. She says, is she hurt? I remember that, asking that. Is she hurt? And I think, well, I don't know, she'll be okay. Maybe we can help her. She says, oh, no, honey. She's dead. She's dead. She's been hit head on. Out on this little country road on the way back out to our ranch. Hit head on. And you know what? She was hit head on by a drunk driver. And just to give you an idea, for those of us who drink and drive, and I did afterwards, she was thrown through to the windshield. It wasn't thrown all the way through, but her face, her chest, everything was crushed. So here's a 62-year-old woman, this wonderful little Southern belle. She's gone, you know. And I gotta tell you, I've never gotten over that, ever. I don't think you ever get over the loss of your mother. None of us do, but that's a tremendous shock. And I was there with my girlfriend, and she couldn't drive a six shift, and people had to come over, and they had to pick us up, and they had to take me home. But, you know, and the only person I wanted in my bed was my dog, you know, so me and my golden retriever, and we got through the funeral, and you know, I was damaged by then, really damaged. And my dad said, hey, don't worry about it, you know, things are not going to change for you. You know, I guess he thought he was going to, like, you know, put the heart, you know, screws to me. He knew that I was already damaged as it was. What are you going to do, you know? So he said, things aren't going to change for you. So I said, well, okay, Dad. Well, you know, I was bawling. He was bawling. He took a Learjet home to Porterville Airport with his clients, so he could be there before they got us home. You know, so in a lot of ways, he was a really good man. So anyway, after that, you would think that after something like that would happen to you, that you wouldn't drink and drive, right? Well, you know, the protector was there, and I was an alcoholic by then, and so I just continued to drink and drive. And what I did was, I can remember coming home from the bench press one night with a girlfriend of mine, and we got pulled over. And I guess this part of the story is there are no consequences. And we got pulled over out on Page Road. And it was a highway patrolman that pulled us over. And he asked for my ID, and I showed him my ID. I guess I didn't blink my lights, and highway patrolmen, they don't like that. They don't like it if you don't blink your lights, you know, got a high beam flashing at them. And he said, give me your ID, and I gave it to him, and he goes, you Jim Houston's son? I said, yeah. He says, oh, hey, he's a friend of mine. He's a friend of mine. I was the police force. He says, well, you need to fix your light. You know, put your lights down. Put your lights down. You guys go on. And I was snockered. I'd had a bottle of wine, a cognac, everything else. I was done for. I was driving that car. Just set on that. Got back to Fresno. I had a buddy who had a Japanese restaurant. I drank sake there pretty liberally, and was making a little bit of a right turn, and some kids in a mini truck go bam like that on me. Now, whether it was their fault or it was mine, I was drunk. So we pull over into this parking lot, I get out, and I'm like, they're like, you're drunk. We know you're drunk. And they were like up in my face. I was like, oh, crap, these kids are going to kill me. You know, we're calling the cops right now. I was like, can't we make a deal? No, you're drunk. We're going to get you. And so I don't remember whether it went to a payphone or whether, I don't know. I can't remember. But anyway, I got a hold of my dad. My dad's like, go to the bar. Go to the bar and start drinking. Is there a bar in that mini ball that you're in? And then, yeah. He says, go to the bar and drink. I'm like, I can't do that. You know, I was too much of a wuss for that. I really was. I mean, it was good legal advice. But some of you know. But I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So, and Julie shares about this, and it's because of the age. Maybe it's because of the age, maybe it's not. But certainly didn't have breathalyzers. He didn't anyway. And he says, the cop gets there, and I'm like, I'm shaking, you know, I'm just shaking. I'm like, oh, God, you know, where's Dad? You know, it's only an hour and a half away. Why isn't he here yet, you know? And I said, he said, say the ABCs backwards. Now, if this isn't a God shot, I don't know what is. Yeah, they did, really, seriously. And they used to say that, you know that, right? Does anybody know that? Raise your hand if you know that. Okay, well, I'm going to tell you where I learned this, but it's something you don't forget when you learn this young. Second grade, actually teach second grade now, but anyway, I don't teach them this. But sometimes I dazzle. sometimes I dazzle him with it. CYXWBUTSRQPOMMLKJIHTFEDCBA. Oh, you're fine, son. You go ahead and go. Those kids were like, no! No, he's drunk! So, anyway, the car was crashed, and he came up, and he fixed it. Once again, no consequences. Not because of him so much, just because of my second grade teacher, but... So I'm going to tell you a little story, and it dovetails into what I have to say later. So, my brother wanted me to come to Fort Lauderdale. He wanted to take me to the Bahamas. He had some clients who deep sea fish, and I had deep sea fishing boat in the Bimini in the Bahamas, and Jerome and Cy. And he said, I want you to come down with me. He was a pilot, and he's an amazing brother. Looking back on it, he's an amazing brother. He didn't like my lifestyle, and I got resentments about it, but looking back on it, what does it say? I know now, or I have clarity now. I wish I had then, but... So we go to the Bahamas, and we land, and I'm there at Hemingway's old bar, you know, what it did for him, right? And we're there talking to Cy and Jerome, and Cy says, hey, you've got to come down to my disco. He says, I got a disco at the end of the island. Now, Bimini's got one road that goes down the middle of the island. Most people ride their bikes. There's not really hardly any cars, and there's little, like, pathways that go off to the left and to the right. Yeah, I want to do that. My brother said, no, we're going to go fishing in the morning. I said, no, I want to go to Cy's place. I want to see. So we went down there, and it's like this little mecca at the very end of the road. It's like, oh, it's like all the neon, Cy's place, the lights are going, and Whitney Houston song, I want to dance with somebody. I can hear it from in the distance. I'm like, yeah. And we get up to the thing, and he goes, hey, you must be Mr. Denman's brother. No, it's half my half-brother, so Mr. Denman. I said, yeah, how did you know? And then I looked around, and every single person was a Bahamian. Everybody, I was the only white guy in the whole place. And he goes, here's a bindle, and there's some champagne up at Cy's office. Why don't you get started up there, and then you can come down later and dance with us. And so I did. I was like, oh, Cy's place is like a whorehouse. It's all red velvet and everything. Long story short, I get in, and I dance, you know, Whitney Houston. Every time I hear that song, I think I saw his place. And you would think that this is all wonderful and great, but really, to tell you the truth, I don't want to glamorize it, and I'll tell you why in a little while. So that night, I'm done, but I need to take some lower companionship, because these people are nice, and I need to find some people who work. So I go walking down that one road, and I think if I go off to this left pathway, this looks like I've got a set for it already. So I'm going to go off this way, because I think that's where I'm going to go. That's where I'm going to find something. And pretty soon I hear this guy behind me. It's like, shh. I'm like, what's going on? He says, don't go that way. Don't go that way. And so I was like, wow, really? Well, who are you? So Cy sent me to watch out for you. You keep going. You keep going. Mr. Dimmitt's brother. So I keep walking. I get to the next bar. Drinks are paid. Next bar, drinks are paid. Next bar, drinks are paid. I get in about 5 in the morning, and my brother's up, ready to go about 6. He's ready to go deep sea fishing. Every time I've been before, since in the Bahamas, beautiful, slick, beautiful waters, clear, see-through, not that morning. Just dying. I'm hardly know. I'll dry heat once again. You know, never learn, do we? And I kept begging him to go in. He got in the middle of a school of dolphin, not flipper, but dolphin. And kept pulling him in. He didn't want to go in. But after my whining and complaining and then he's like, okay, go in, you know. And he's like, we're not staying in that. Get in the plane. You know, and so that's like one of the many times where I could have been in the moment with my brother
spent time with my brother, been around my brother that I wasn't able to. He gave me some amazing, amazing parts of my life. And that's just one example. So anyway, I go back to Fresno State. I don't want to graduate from college. I'm on the 10-year plan. I'm not working. All I do is go to school. I'm starting to like it now. I'm actually getting good grades. And I go to law school. And I go to law school at San Joaquin College of Law. There was 120 of us to begin with. After the first year, there was only 60 of us. The only reason I made it was because there wasn't any rock star at the time, but I stayed awake somehow. And I decided, no, I hate this, and I'm going, I can't deal with this. And I called my dad and I said, hey, I can't deal with this. This is horrible. I'm going to hate this. He's like, I always knew you weren't going to like it. But you would have moaned and complained and everything else if I didn't let you go do it. So you did it. So now, you go to your brother's. So I was like, okay, Fort Lickerdale, here I come. So, and plus I'll do a geographical and I'll stop all the other, you know, and I'll be okay. So I got placed and placed up on the, like, you know, way up on the 15th floor overlooking the Atlantic, loving it. Had one friend who was a foodaholic. I had another friend who was a alcoholic. Hung out with them. One of them took me to the happy hour because he liked to eat. So I woke up and down the elevator, take a nap, go to the happy hour, go out to drink, go to the bar. That was really great. So one day I was out there on the beach and I said, I got to do something. I got to get a job. I got to have a career. What am I going to do for my life? Having an epiphany. So I decided I'm going to go to chef school. So I went in and I got in the restaurant business. And I went to chef school. No resume, nothing like that. And I got to chef school and I got into a great restaurant. And I worked at the restaurant business. There's a lot of alcoholics in the restaurant business. And I was sitting right in with that deal. And they put me in charge of the wine. I was the sommelier. Did that about 4 years. Then I ended up on an island, a little barrier island between Miami and Fort Lauderdale. And the reason I ended up there is because I was looking for a place to live. I was tired of the place I was living in. I had a roommate who was an alcoholic in chef school, and I was tired of him. And I was like, I need to change of pace. So I was driving over this bridge, and I heard about this beach. It's like a land that time forgot, you know? And I was like, I love this place. And so I rented a bungalow, and I just hung out there, and I had a great boss. He had plenty of money, 16-room hotel, ended up going to work for him, got a fortune in that place. We played around all day long. Not played, we worked hard, but, you know, I mean, we weren't worried about making a living. About that time, my dad had kidney transplant, goes bankrupt, loses everything, all the money gets cut off. But who cares? I'm on Fantasy Island, you know? I'm already taken care of, right? I'm working 12-hour days, and I'm doing what I love, right? So a buddy of mine comes in there, and he goes one day, he goes, hey, you know what? You're a drunk ass. He says, every day I can tell that you've been drinking all night. He says, and my buddy quit drinking. And he was younger than me. He was a hard worker, smart kid. And I said, you know what? I can do that, too. I'm going to quit drinking, too. So I remember my boss looking across the way, this gal that laid out there all the time in the sun. And she kind of looked weathered and miserable. And he goes, look at her. She's an alcoholic. She doesn't drink anymore. Well, look at how miserable she is. She's just a miserable drunk. And I remember him saying that so many times. He hated her. She's a miserable drunk. And I said, but she doesn't drink. She's still a miserable drunk. Well, what she was she was a dry drunk. You know? Well, that sounds good to me. That's what I'm going to be. A dry drunk, you know? Man. So I went over to her. I said, hey, how'd you quit drinking? She didn't say, hey, you got to go to meetings. You got to do this. You got to do that. No, she just said, here's the book. Read it. So what did I read? I read the stories. Kind of like a novel a little bit, you know? The first 164 pages, how it works. I admit I was an alcoholic, none of that. Yeah, stories, that was it. And didn't go to meetings, didn't have a support group. But I stopped drinking. Stopped drinking about 3 years. And then it came time to come back home.
And so the reason it came time to come back home is I told my aunt when I left over a decade before that, when it comes time, when Dad's old and it's time for me to come home, you need to tell me. And she told me it's time for you to come home. Well, he's been falling down in the house, and he's been bankrupt. I told you guys that story. And so I came home, and I was drive drunk, so I was a happy guy. And I was like, dang, there's no more money, you know, and what am I going to do there? I live on an island, I work for a millionaire, and now I'm going to go home to an old, sick, poor man. So I landed in Las Vegas, which I don't know why, but I figured maybe he's working the dollar machines or something. Landed in, and there was an entourage in the lobby of this casino waiting for me, and apparently it became very clear that this was no longer a problem, and that things had changed for him. So we got back to the house, I can remember thinking, you know, I can remember thinking that this is weird. So slowly but surely things were revealed to me that were very strange about my dad's occupation. You know, before he handled murders, you know, this guy, that guy. And I asked the houseboy one day, I says, why doesn't anybody lock the doors in this house? And he says, don't you know who your dad's clients are? I said, but there's like hundreds of thousands of dollars running around the house all the time in briefcases and everything like that. And he goes, like I said, don't you know who your dad's clients are? Nobody's going to come and touch this house. Nobody's going to come near this house. So I was like, oh my gosh, I'm living in a drug den here, you know. But it wasn't a drug den. It was just, you know, it was a whole different lifestyle. And so I went off and went here and I went there, and things didn't change much other than I was just miserable. So then he died. He died 2.5 years later, so that makes me a dry drunk for about 3.5 years. And I know it's a big surprise to you, but I didn't have a support group. He was in intensive care for a month and a half up in Stanford, and not one person came up with me up there. Now, there was a huge bunch of people at the funeral, all the people that loved him and cared about him, but all those people in Porterville were like, he is a pariah. Stay away from him. No support group there. I had some friends. I had some normie friends who love me and care about me. I've known them for 20 or 30 years. But for the most part, I really don't have a support group. And he died, and I went down quick. I went up north, and I started seeking out Lord companionship more quicker than ever. And what ended up happening was I went to the doctor, and I was diagnosed with a horrible little disease called hepatitis C. And they said, you're going to die. You can either get sober or you'll die. Okay, dang, you know. Okay, well, that was pretty shocking. It's a shocking disease. And back then, it's a little bit of an easier road now, but back then, if you drank at all or did anything like that and you took those medications, you would just definitely be sick. So you had to be sober 6 months. So I remember talking to my doctor and I'm saying, are you sure I just can't drink wine and get rid of, you know, the hard liquor? Can I just drink wine or beer, light alcohol? Would that be okay? And he's like, no, you got to quit drinking completely. So I went to my first meeting. I went to my first meeting to save my life. And I can remember coming home from that meeting. And I was like, I was happy. I truly was the epitome after that night of happy, joyous, and free. It's not like overnight, but that night, I can remember walking home. Because, by the way, when I came back home to Porterville, and by the way, I told you I shouldn't have done this, but I know I've been all over the map. But I literally came back to Porterville. My buddy, who was a lawyer up in Fresno, said, oh my God, this place is eating you alive. You need to go back to Porterville. So he put me on a train, gave me some money, which I drank up on the train, and he got me to Porterville. And then when I finally started to get sober, I went to meetings in Porterville. And I can remember coming home from that meeting, and I was just so, so happy. I was happy. I was truly happy, joyous, and free. Because I was like, I was coming home from that meeting, just like bouncing. It was amazing. And I look back on it now, and the reason why I was so happy is because I had hope.
I had hope that one day at a time, I could get better. One day at a time, I could repair the liver damage. I could repair my mental state. I could repair my financial state. I could repair all those things. So that's what I did. And I got a sponsor. Something I tried to get. I went to a brief stint in rehab, did a bunch of play that kind of thing, never got a sponsor, never did those things. So at least I knew what I had to do. So I got a sponsor. And then I worked the steps with my sponsor. And I started to learn something about how I think, how my patterns of behavior are, my patterns of thinking, all of the things that I used to not understand why I felt the way I felt. I all of a sudden understood how I felt, why I felt them. And so she, I just continued to go to meetings. I felt better, I felt better, I felt better. And then I had to go through those treatments. And I'll tell you, this is the most amazing thing. My grand sponsor, who is afraid of needles, used to have to poke yourself in the stomach with this needle. The nurse came and she was there for like 2 hours and my grand sponsor sat there the whole time. She got all this information so I would know later on. Because that's the kind of thing where you may not know everything that's going on. And after a year of those treatments, my disease is clear. I don't have it anymore. But you know, the thing is it was because I suited up and I showed up. I never stopped going to meetings. I was sick as a dog every day. And people would come and pick me up, take me to meetings, pick me up, take me to meetings, pick me up, take me to meetings. So anyway, I talk a little bit about service and what's happened in my life recently. Recently, the last 2 years, like I said, I met that gal that was down there on the end of the, on that end of the saxophone session, and at a meeting by happenstance, in Visalia. And you know, this fellowship is an amazing thing because it has a ripple effect, you know, and so that guy going, don't go that way. Well, now that guy's going, there's a person for you. There's a person for you. There's another person for you. So that person knows this person, knows that person, you know? And I think it's kind of evident tonight that there's some amazing people in my life. People that I've met that God's put in my life because, for whatever reason, you know? And it just, it gets better and better and better. And they say that, watch out, they, you know, the miracle will happen. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Well, I gotta tell you, the people in my life today are a miracle. They're a miracle that they're in my life. Tell you a little story. I have a sponsor at the church tonight. And my whole life I've golfed. I've golfed some great golf courses. I've golfed them all really badly. And I've always golfed them drunk. Always drunk. Especially after the ninth hole. I would golf somewhat good the first nine holes. And then once the clubhouse turned, then it just slowly went down from there. You know? And I never really enjoyed it. And we have a little golf course in town, and I went there with my great grand sponsor. And she said, you need to be in this tournament with me. We got to go practice. We got to start practicing. So we go out there and we start practicing, and it was the first time I'd ever golfed when I was sober. And I got to tell you, I was awesome. It was just awesome. And you know, we won the tournament. She'd been last every year, and I had a ringer who was a buddy of mine, and he played with us, and we won the tournament. But beyond winning the tournament is that I realized I could do something that I always used to do drunk, and I can do it sober. That's an amazing thing. And you know, I gotta tell you, being with her out there, she's like so peaceful, so calm. I do stuff, and she's like, well, that didn't happen a while ago, so why do you still have that going on? It's kind of like one of those things that reminds you, if I'm disturbed because there's something inside of me, then, wow, I'm learning this stuff out on the golf course. I'm like, do you charge for this? Because this is really great, you know? I love this, you know? So I guess back to service. I'm the vice president of the board of directors. Julie's the president of the board of directors. And we do a lot of things. We do a lot of different things. We have a meeting once a month in Exeter. I know some people from here that are from that meeting, and more people that you get to meet. And you know, that's being of service. You started that meeting in Portville, and that's being of service. I get to be a sponsor to some, over the time, some wonderful people and a wonderful person who's actually here tonight. You get to see your sponsors grow. You get to give back. You get to do all of the things that make you even more happy, joyous, and free. And it doesn't have anything to do with how much money you have or what you do for a living. You know, I get to work with kids. And Tom called me this morning and he said, "Just be yourself." And I said, "Oh God, that's poor people." No, what I said was, I'm getting ready to go work with 25 7-year-olds. So I really don't think about myself. All I'm thinking about is getting out of myself and seeing what they need. What do you guys need? What do you want? You know? And wow, it turned out that all of those things that I got protected from, all of those things that I didn't have any consequences for, God had a different plan. He had a plan that I wouldn't go off to the left down that little road. He had a plan that I wouldn't have gone down to Las Vegas walking because my dad left me with money and I was down in Tupac country, you know. And I didn't get killed there. I didn't get killed in Houston. I didn't get killed in New Orleans. I mean, against all odds, really true. Against all odds. He had a plan for me. And, you know, that's another way I get to get back. Because in my career, in my vocation, as my friend likes to call me, I have this friend, she said, she's British, and she said, "You put your sobriety date up on that calendar, you cheeky booger." And today, that lady is so proud of me, and she says, "You don't just have a job." She said, "You have a vocation." You know, and I gotta tell you, this is the most amazing thing. It's truly because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I get to do those things. I get to wake up at 6 o'clock, 5:30, and be happy. I'm not, "Oh God, I gotta get up and go take care of these kids." And I'm happy. And I'm grateful for all of that. And so I hope I covered everything you wanted me to cover. My name's Doug, and I'm an alcoholic.